when you're all alone in the Philippines or you're all alone in Taiwan or wherever, you're just kind of on your own and you have to make things work, then you start to become resourceful because you are out of options. You have to. I mean, nobody cares but you. You have to help yourself. And that's what I did in a million different situations. And then over time that accumulates. Oh my God, okay. I have never talked about this.
Welcome to Live with Bitcoin, where we explore the life, culture, and transformative power in Bitcoin. I'm your host, Vivian. Thanks for tuning in. Today, our guest is Lina Zaihia, the creator and mom of The Little Hodler, Queen Comic, and an iconic figure on Bitcoin Twitter, and the bedside of thousands of existing and future Bitcoiners. Welcome, Lina.
Thank you. That was a great intro, and you pronounced my last name properly.
Yes,
which is rare.
Thanks for joining the show. First, would you mind telling us briefly what is your Bitcoin story?
I grew up in Germany. Then I left Germany at 18 years old. I finished high school, left Germany, and went traveling, mostly Asia for the longest time, actually. And then during that time, while I was like digital nomading, so to say, I, in 2017, stumbled into the Bitcoin space. Although I would say I stumbled into the shitcoin space. So it was the ICO time, like that mad time. And I was doing marketing that time. I was assigned to some projects in the space. So actually for the longest time, I had no touching points with Bitcoin. So you'd be going to these conferences, these meetups and that, where they, like the blockchain meetups. So you're going to have all these suited up people coming in, and all they do is walk around and ask for partnerships and shill each other their coins. And it was really, really horrible. And like, the more I did it, the less I felt fulfilled. And the more I was questioned, like, what am I actually doing here? I met different people in different places who then, through those people, I met Bitcoiners, and those Bitcoiners gave me books. And then I started actually reading about Bitcoin. So the first Bitcoin book I read was The Internet of Money by Andreas Antonopoulos. And then the second was The Bitcoin Standard, which are two very different books. And I definitely recommend reading The Internet of Money first, because it's like this, whereas The Bitcoin Standard is like this. So, and it's a very easy read. It's very easy to get into. And that made me question a lot of things and view them in a different light, which I hadn't before. And then from that point on, I pivoted into Bitcoin.
Today, would you consider yourself a Bitcoin maximalist?
That is a very heavy word.
What is your definition of being a Bitcoin maximalist, I guess?
By the definition of the term would be that you're Bitcoin only, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not interested in or hodling or touching anything that isn't Bitcoin. And then there are people who take it even further, who are like, I'm not going to touch the dollar, but I don't believe them. So I've been labeled a Bitcoin maximalist, and it's my own fault. For the longest time, I was in that corner of Twitter and like pushing these Bitcoin tweets and being all like that, because it was good for, it was that time where that was really good for engagement. And that's what we needed at the time. So it's my own fault. I pushed myself into that corner. But I think I am too peaceful for that. So that part of, I'm perfectly fine with it. So actually, I am not interested in anything but Bitcoin. I think Tether is fine. Or stable. No, I'll say Tether, because there are very bad stable coins out there. But Tether is really fine. I use it. I've used it for a long time, and I know many people who use it. And Tether is really, really popular in emerging markets, for example, right? So maybe that disqualifies me as a maximalist, but I think it's also not, I think it's a flexible term in that sense. But yeah, so I'm not interested in anything but Bitcoin and Tether, but I don't care if other people are. And a lot of people would say, and that is like third-party labeling, that maximalists are toxic, because, you know, there's been some like taking over that term thing going on, where people proudly call themselves a toxic maximalist. So that's kind of the the association with the term. And if that is the term you go by, then now I am not. But also, I don't care if you call me one, and I don't care if you call me something else. I like Bitcoin.
I guess the very fact of the success of the little hodler, it says a lot of how you can be Bitcoin only without being toxic, and how you don't have to be toxic to really orange pill people. When you enter the realm of Bitcoin, where did you first find the alignment between your personal beliefs, who you are, between Bitcoin?
Oh, interesting question. What I did like about Bitcoin / Bitcoiners was the don't trust verify idea. The idea that you, and that's something that I think to an extent I was practicing it before, which was when I was reading news, I would read multiple sources, for example, because I noticed that there was a lot of bias going on. So I thought myself really smart. I'm like, oh, I'm not just going to read CNN. I'm going to read the BBC too. And then I'm going to read a German outlet, and then I'll be super informed. Of course, that's nonsense, because this stuff goes way deeper than just, that media outlet says this and that says that. So the truth is in the middle. No, that's nonsense. But anyway, so I saw that in the Bitcoin space, because Bitcoin space is very much like, okay, we're not going to let anybody mess with us and manipulate us. We're going to verify. So I did like that a lot. And the more you get into that realm, the deeper you dive into the space, the more you're confronted with it. And then you see that it like seeps into other areas of life. So that's why a lot of Bitcoiners are talking about diet and about frying pans and about many other things that where you go, oh, that doesn't have anything to do with Bitcoin, but it's a mindset thing. And I think that is a good thing to take away, so long as you stay self-aware of your personal limitations in don't trust verify.
I was literally thinking about this yesterday, and I was asking myself the very fact of Bitcoiners adopting this mentality of don't trust verify, along the way you become a sovereign individual and you learned the skill of critical thinking by the process of constantly verifying and not just simply blindly trust. But if you start to adapt, you know, the don't trust verify mentality into everything in your life, then you find yourself having a hard time trusting ever again to anything and anyone in any situations or any source. And maybe this is, I just had this random thought yesterday. I'm like, is this literally legitimizing our trust issues as individuals? And is there a possibility that there's a drawback of this mentality? What do you think?
I think it's even worse than that. I think this is what we think is happening, but what's actually happening, we are still trusting, but we are trusting other sources and thinking that we are verifying, because it is impossible to verify everything. So at some point you will resort to trusting. So we, as an example, we go, oh, we don't trust the media. What do we trust? Oh, we trust the guy on Twitter. That's not better. But you cannot verify everything. Just as an example, the whole, I mentioned it, a lot of Bitcoiners are interested in different diets. Actually, they're only interested in carnivorism for some reason. But so nutritional science is a huge deal, right? That thing, that whole sector in and on itself is almost unverifiable, because let's say you do a study on whether eating only meat is good for you. If you want to do a representative study, then you'd have to get a lot of people in. Let's say you find those people, but then you cannot monitor them 24/7. That's pretty Orwellian. So what you would have to do technically is you'd have to lock them up and you'd have to monitor everything, which obviously it's not going to happen. But even then, they're different people with different clinical pasts. So it's just an example of how the results of studies are extremely hard to verify, and you will almost always find a study in your favor or in favor of your argument and against your argument. And there are studies that are studies that are presented certain ways, interpreted certain ways, and pushed into certain directions. So this is just one example of where, of how you cannot verify everything. But if we think we can verify everything, we're beyond trusting. We're above the normies who fall for the headlines in the media. We do the exact same thing, but we do it somewhere else, or we do it on a different level. Maybe we're one step up from the guy who watches Fox News and says, oh, Biden bad. No, actually that's true. So who watches, I don't know, who watches MSN or CNBC or whatever, who says, oh, Bitcoin bad. Then we're like, yeah, you don't get it because you didn't verify, but we did. But that guy is here. We are here. But the truth is way up there. So I think it's even more dangerous than saying we have trust issues, because we just trust different things. So that's how, you know, conspiracies happen too. But then which conspiracy theories are conspiracy theories and which aren't? What we're just stuck in is information overload and so many sources. And because we don't trust the official sources anymore, we're left wondering, who do we trust? Can we trust anybody? And then we trust whoever seems the most reasonable, which we're going to think is the person who says, yeah, don't trust the media. So we're like, yeah, that guy's right about that. So he must be right about the other thing too.
I'm so glad that you said it, because someone has to say it. And if you think about the entire concept of like conspiracy theorist, the word, the definition of conspiracy is very, already have a very negative connotation. And if you call someone a conspiracy theorist, then you're already accusing them for saying something that's not true, like by definition of the word conspiracy. So it's just very hard. There's a fine line between truth and what we believe to be true. And I guess truth is so different for individuals, and we all have our definitions. And it's very valuable for you to be able to stand up and say that we don't know the truth. Like, we don't know everything, even though we think that we do.
It's impossible to see the full scale of everything. I think the reality of the world is much more convoluted than we think, and nothing is black and white, and there's no... what we think to be good or evil is not as clear as we think it is. What we tend to fall into as humans is labeling and simplifying concepts, right? So we look for the villain to blame our problems on. And for Bitcoiners, that's the central bank, right? Or that is the politician that wants to ban Bitcoin. And then we cheer for the politician that loves Bitcoin, and we set aside other things because of that one factor that confirms our narrative. So it's like how you let things slide because they don't fit your worldview. And we are very much... That is one thing that we are very much, we fall victim to. And it's very hard to get out of that. And I think even if you're aware of it, it still happens. Because again, you cannot verify everything. So you just kind of always have to be in that mindset that you're like, yeah, things are probably not the way they seem. But then you also drive yourself crazy, right? So there's nothing wrong with simplifying things. And there's nothing wrong with labeling things. And so I'm not one of them people like, oh, don't put that label on me. No, it's normal. But it's good to be aware of your shortcomings and of the fact that you tend to, for example, look for a group to belong to. So we look to other Bitcoiners and we find our parallels. We group ourselves together and then we feel stronger and we push each other. And then we ourselves shape narratives and make ourselves believe them. So nobody is safe from that. And it's very easy to get stuck in it. Bitcoin's a lifeboat, I said, but you cannot live on a lifeboat. right? So Bitcoin is one factor, but when a currency collapses, it takes an entire country with it. There is a lot more attached to it, and you cannot just go, oh, I have Bitcoin, I'm good now.
I feel like people gravitate on this view is partially because of desperation, almost like. Like you said, we live in a time where there's so much uncertainty. There's so much things going on that are out of our control. And it's good to latch onto some sort of pure hopium, to have really good hope, to have hope. And think that, you know, we have this and we got this, to give us a peace of mind, I guess. But this is where the danger come in. Like you said, we can't consider Bitcoin is everything. We can't consider Bitcoin is the single solution to all of our lives problems. And this is where I see the risk of Bitcoiners adopting this belief and ended up believing in this and slacking off on other areas in their lives. And I'm glad that you come out and say this, and recognizing that we know better, but we don't at the same time. And it's good to stay humble, have the mindset of how can we live our lives better as individuals with Bitcoin, instead of, oh, we have Bitcoin, we're good to go. And it's been a long time since you were in the space. How do you think, and you've been traveling this whole time pretty much, how do you think Bitcoin have changed you? Or do you think Bitcoin have changed you in any way?
For the simple reason that I've been working in the Bitcoin space all this time, obviously it has shaped me, just because of the circles that I've been around, which is also... In a way, it's really good, because when you go to a new country, you immediately know, I'm going to look up the local Bitcoin meetup. And then you immediately have a starting point. It's so in that sense, it gives community, right? Which is, again, it can be the same. Like, for example, if you you love manga or anime, and then you will find your local community, like you're a huge Pokemon fan or something, you're going to find a local Pokemon Go players or something. So that's a very simple, straightforward way that it shaped me, because most of the people I would meet and I would hang with would be Bitcoiners or Bitcoiner adjacent. And aside from that, and this is a very cliche answer, but it extended my horizon, time horizon, I mean. Because I was able to lower my time preference, because obviously your perspective on saving changes, and not investing. Actually, for me, it was never an investment. I never looked at Bitcoin as an investment. It was always a way to save, especially then when I would see countries where inflation is rampant. I never looked at Bitcoin as anything other than a way to save. And that is something that I think came in very handy for me, because you don't really fall victim to the whole FOMO situation. But there's also a type question, I think. But in that sense, it expanded my time horizon, because then I can plan further and I can say, okay, look, there's a pattern here. It's a 4-year cycle here, right? Also on a business side, it helps you that you're kind of able to anticipate certain things. It helps you that when you fall into a bear market, you're like, okay, shit happens. This is going to be 2 years now, but you know, just survive, then you'll be fine. So you kind of develop that sense that, you know, okay, I can plan around this. And this was always a given kind of for me, because I just kind of slid into it. But then, you know, the pandemic happened, and a lot of people started struggling financially and economically, lost their jobs and those kinds of things. And I saw for the first time the extent of financial illiteracy and the extent of the normalization of debt, for example. It's almost too normal to be in debt. And that completely kills your time preference. And that is something that I was luckily not exposed to, and that I never developed, and that Bitcoin helped me develop in the opposite direction, really. That's probably one of the big ones. And then, of course, the fact that you see, for example, how the media slanders Bitcoin, and that really shapes your view on official information. And then we're back at Don't Trust Verify, right? But that is a big one for me, and that spills over into other parts of life, where then you go, okay, so if the media reports on Bitcoin and it's really stupid and uninformed and slanderous, then if they report on a war, for example, can I trust them? So you just become more careful and cautious in, or I became more careful and cautious in voicing opinions too fast.
What is your hypothesis of why we still have so few women in Bitcoin today? And I'm sure in earlier days, it must have been even worse compared to men.
It's the patriarchy. No, I'm kidding. Finance is very technical. Technology is very technical. And these are topics that are generally more, that appeal more to men. And I think I first heard Jordan Peterson say this, but I don't know if they echoed him, but he said that women are more interested in people, whereas men are more interested in things. That stuck with me. I didn't verify it, but it makes sense to me. So, because you can see, for example, nursing jobs, kindergarten, hospitals, the jobs that involve caring for people are more often held by women, whereas the technical jobs are more often held by men. So why would that be different with Bitcoin? Bitcoin is very intangible, which is why I do what I do. But it's no surprise to me. And I think it's a fallacy that you think money is like a masculine thing in that sense, that it's so not interesting for women, because obviously money is for everybody. But I think it's normal to say for many women, and I'm generalizing, but just as a whole, for women to go, yeah, like, I'm not going to get into that. Like, that seems so boring. And so then you end up with that.
There are actually more women in Bitcoin, way more these days. And I've been talking to people, and their impression is that women are way less in the spotlights in Bitcoin. Like, even if they work in Bitcoin, where they're active Bitcoiners who are huddling, they're typically in the background and are either shy or not comfortable of kind of pinpointing that identity about themselves publicly. Like, I feel like intrinsically women are more modest in a way. Like, we would, and there's a study in job hunting saying that women would only apply for a job when they feel like they require, that they can fulfill 100% of the responsibility listed in the job post. Whereas men, if they fulfill maybe like 40% of, you know, what the job asks for, they would confidently like apply for the job. So that's, I'm sure there's some degree of truth in that. And I feel like women are less comfortable of taking credits. They're less aggressive in the sense of, I want to be on top, I want to be seen. And they're less comfortable of making it public that they're working in Bitcoin, they're Bitcoiners. So that plays a factor. I feel like women in Bitcoin share this commonality, in my impression, that they have such a strong idea of what they want. Like, they're all very driven in the sense that they've thought about life and they've thought about who they are. And they're very clear on what they want as an individual and as a woman. And I think that's incredible. Have you seen any commonalities or similarities in women in Bitcoin?
I find that very interesting that you say they're driven. I think you're right. I think you're right. And I think it's mostly because they, maybe they have their own startups, or they are in, they're part of a startup, which the chance that you're part of a startup in the Bitcoin space is very high, because a lot of Bitcoin companies are startups, and in a startup, you wear many hats. You have to be driven or you're not going to make it. It's not a cushy 9-to-5. that you have for 40 years and you're good. In a startup, everything moves very fast. In the Bitcoin space, everything moves very fast. So I think commonality among people in the Bitcoin space is that we have this awareness that we have to be on top of everything because, for example, we need to time the bull and bear markets and we need to be ready. We basically have to be like the bears, you know. We eat a lot of fish during the bull markets, and then during the bear market, we don't eat, or we eat ramen or whatever. So I would think that, and I'm not saying like, oh, it's so hard to be in the Bitcoin space. Like, no, like that's just startup life, right? But as a result of that, yeah, women in the space would be very driven. And I never thought about it that way. It's just a random thought that you just triggered in me, but you're right about that. And aside from that, actually, I see a lot of colorful mixes in like the kinds of women that I meet and that I see. So you can't say like, oh, all the women in the Bitcoin space, they are like, they're like conservative women who want to appeal to the Bitcoin alpha males. Nah, you see all shapes and forms, and you see everything. And especially actually in the German speaking space lately, which in and of itself is a huge, very tight knit community. I see a lot of women lately coming up and doing things, which is great. And in general, I think it's amazing. And I love it. I never much focused on it actually. Because I'm a bit allergic to being put on women in Bitcoin panels, for example, because I'm like, dude, I have more qualities than my gender. But it depends on how it's run, obviously, because sometimes you get really good topics. Because, for example, the questions you're asking, the things you are doing, and the podcast that you're hosting, it's not. I see your point with it, and I agree with it, which is simply that there's a feminine perspective which speaks to another audience than the general content that you put out there. And I really love that. And I think that is extremely, extremely valuable. And I do appreciate that. And I do see more of that lately.
Thanks a lot. You're on the road a lot and oftentimes by yourself. And that requires a lot of courage and capability to be really self-reliant and dealing with all uncertainty and tricky situations and foreign environments. It's a very prominent part in being in Bitcoin as well, is that not everyone's super comfortable with uncertainty, that what Bitcoin represents, either from the price perspective or just everything else around us. There's a lot of uncertainty involved. So how do you typically approach uncertainty? And where do you think you acquired that strength?
I think I acquired it in ignorance, because I went to, so as I said, when I was 18, I finished high school and then I went overseas. So straight up, I went to Japan, I went to Malaysia, and then I spent a lot of time in Asia, Southeast Asia for the most part. And I just went. And it was very un-German of me. I had no plan. I didn't know what to do and where and how and whatever. And that naivety and that ignorance threw me in situations where I had to fix them. I had to help myself because I hadn't thought about it before. If I had thought about all these things, all the possibilities, all the potential outcomes and consequences, I would never have left. It's the same with starting a company or starting my company. If I had thought it all through, I would have never stopped planning. So that kind of stupidity helped me acquire the skill of problem solving. And it helped me in the sense that, you know, when you're all alone in the Philippines, or you're all alone in Taiwan or wherever, and there is nobody around, you're just kind of on your own and you have to make things work, then you start to become resourceful because you are out of options. You have to. I mean, nobody cares but you. You have to help yourself. And that's what I did in a million different situations. And then over time that accumulates, right? I have this chronic issue that I wouldn't believe in myself. And I say I still have it to an extent, which actually comes back to where you said women only apply for a job when they think they have 100% of the skills required. I agree, and I think it is, for some reason, I mean, Jordan Peterson would probably know, but it's a very female thing to do that and to think that way. So this I was always faced with, this being self-conscious and being like, oh shit, I got myself into another situation. Now do I sort it? Slowly but surely, like gradually, I'd realize, hold on, I solved that. Hold on, I fixed that. Hold on, I got over that. Hold on, I'm still alive. Mm-hmm. And then you build that confidence where you're like, okay, even if shit hits the fan, even if everything that could go wrong does go wrong, I can fix it. And then another part is also just habit, right? You start, they say the earlier you start traveling, the easier it gets, because the older you get, the more settled in you become. Not just because you buy stuff, or you have your friends, right? But because it's a mindset sort of thing. So you just kind of, I was so used to it. I didn't think about it. I wasn't planning on just going around country to country to country. That also just happened. But because it just happened, it became easier. And so I'm at a point where it's not scary for me to move countries, for example. It's still a hassle.
Sometimes we acquire certain skills just because we're in that situation. And there's no other person to help us figure it out. And it's all on us to figure out the situation. And you can choose to cry over it. But at the end of the day, it's still up to you to walk that path, no matter how long you cry over it, right? Like, don't cry over the spilt milk. Like,
they call it high agency, I think.
And I agree with you that confidence is oftentimes built upon positive feedback loop. So that's why I think a lot of people need to hear this, is that if you're in a place where you feel you're stuck, or you don't know where else to go necessarily, then try to focus on creating small wins for yourself. Like, it doesn't have to be something that's so grand. It can even be, today I got out of bed, you know, like today I went out for a walk. Today I
overachiever. I get
tell
it.
Me about it. But yeah, like, it can be a really small win. You're doing these mundane daily activities, but at least you're moving forward, and you have to give yourself those credit and consider them as small wins to slowly build up that confidence. And you have to have that patience over time. And I was tweeting the other day, I was thinking the other day that we as humans, we need to learn how to show up for ourselves before anybody does, and then continue to do so when the party is over. And if you do this, if you constantly do this consistently, rain or shine, then things will start to improve. And I promise. And I think you have lived through a million situations where life was like that, and you showed up for yourself. And I think now to have that strength to say, I can end up in any situations in any country and still be able to figure it out, I bet it's incredibly empowering as an individual. To have that mindset, to have that self-confidence. And of course, as individuals, like as humans, of course, we suffer imposter syndrome at times. We suffer self-doubts from sometimes. It's just part of the mix. But I think at this point, you've lived through enough of these situations where you have that confidence to navigate through tricky situations, knowing that you'll be fine because you have enough positive experience, positive feedback loop that give you... And yes, exactly. And negative experience that you have survived to give you that confidence. Let's talk about the little huddler. I know that you started this journey with no particular agenda or expectations. And to see it take off like that, it must have been a great journey. So in hindsight, what do you think are some of the factors that contribute to little huddler's success?
the fact that I didn't plan it, because I did not plan it. I just started doing the comics, because if I had, I would have thought, okay, so this is a male-dominated industry. It's mostly adult guys, and I am about to make plushies. So I'm glad I didn't think about it. What made Little Hodler successful, I think, is the simplification of everything and the cutification of it. It's very cute, whereas everything else is very technical and very abstract. So Little Hodler is this unassuming character that just walks through every Bitcoiner's life and lives through the experiences that we can relate to and that we understand. And he tells stories that we can share with our loved ones. So my job is taking complicated concepts and making them easy. And then my second job is taking abstract things and making them cuddly. And that is something that wasn't done before, not to this extent, and not to this, I think, consistency, you know, because I developed a style and stuck with it. That's another thing. And again, I wasn't planning for it. It's just because I like my things pretty and colorful and cute, because I lived in Japan for a long time and I was a huge Japan fan for a long time and still am. And so the knowledgeable anime connoisseur among my followers will know that my characters are very inspired by anime and whatnot. So those are all things that helped. And then obviously because I've been around for 7 years, what the hell? Like doesn't even feel like that. So I know a lot of I know the journey that you go through, right? And I'm still going through that journey too. And as we go, a lot of crazy things happen. Like 2021, Elon Musk's crazy like short-term Bitcoin trip. 2021 also, El Salvador's Bitcoin law, which gave me heaps of inspiration. And so these things happen, and you just kind of take the opportunities. And then as you get feedback, and I would see people posting my plushies. And actually last week, for the first time, my brother sent me a message, how he got a message from a colleague, I think. The colleague, not a Bitcoiner, was visiting a friend, also not a Bitcoiner, or at least he didn't know he was. And he would see one of my plushies in the living room. And he texted my brother. He's like, dude, I'm seeing those things out in the wild. And my brother's like, yo, dude, that dude is seeing things out in the wild. So it's really, it gives me a really good feeling, and it encourages me to keep going, right? And then I see how it helps people. And so it's again, it's the feedback loop.
You have this ability to transform something that's complicated and a little bit boring and technical into something that's wholesome and entertaining. So can you walk us through the process when you create each comic? Like, how do you generate the idea, and how do you transform something that's so complex into something that's cute?
It's a mix of just being on top of what's happening and then trying to visualize it, which I'm going to explain in a bit, but then also just the more you do it, the better you get at it. So at the beginning, I was really, really bad, but there were some concepts, like evergreen concepts, that would work. So I would focus on these, and then news would come. I mean, where sometimes these stories literally ish write themselves. Yesterday, where international media called out El Salvador for, I don't know, election, the democratic backsliding, blah, blah, blah. It's like a common theme. It happens all the time, right? And the president then went and turned it around. He's like, you know, I wish there were fair elections in the US. Which, if you break that down, everybody knows why that's funny. Because it's so ridiculous that the US has been doing that for the longest time with no proof whatsoever. Whereas the moment he turns around, it's like, oh, how dare you, dictator. So the thing that you do, or the thing that I would do in this situation, is break it down into that. You know, why is that tweet funny? And you don't explain the joke because then it's no longer funny, right? But everybody can tell, okay, this is why I laughed about it, or this is why it made me smile. Then think about how you're going to explain that to your neighbor or your friend. And so you need to take the essence of it. And in many cases, it is absurdity, because many of my comics depict the absurd. So it is absurd that the US has been going around, not just the US, but like, I'm just taking the US as an example. The US has been going around saying, El Salvador losing a dictatorship. Whereas then you come here and you're like, oh, hold on, like crime is basically non-existent. People are much better than they used to it. You go on the street. If you go on the street in the US or in let's say Germany, I'm German, right? You go on the street in Germany, you ask people, is life better now than 10 years ago? Or is it worse now? We know the answer that you're going to get. People are very unhappy with their government. If you do this in El Salvador, you will get the exact opposite. So it's absurd that you would call that out. And there's a lot of narrative behind it. But that's the key part. You call something out that is very easily disproven. So you take that message and you put it into panels.
So let's talk about creativity. So first, do you think everyone can be creative?
It's not black and white. The people are more creative, other people are less creative, but then they have other skills. And then you have some superhumans who can do everything, right? But that's the exception to the rule. So for example, I'm very creative, but I'm really bad at math. So other people are really good at coding or other things like that, but they will not have the creativity to create stories. It's just fine, you know. That's why some people are engineers and some people are screenwriters.
Because you basically stumbled upon this, right, out of a hobby and out of something that's close to your heart. And for those who don't yet know that they can be creative, what are the things that you think they can do to try to explore and unlock that creative side of theirs?
Interesting. That's about kind of finding your inner Picasso or whatever, right? If you don't know it exists. So I can't teach you how to find out whether you have a philosophical mind or whatever, right? That's not my forte. But if you do have that tendency, then in order to find your way to express it, there are obviously things you can do. And in the end, it comes down to practice and to trying things. And so I was not planning on being an artist a drawing artist. I was not planning on drawing stuff for a living. I always enjoyed it, but I had no idea that stuff could be monetized, for example. It just sort of happened that I did it for fun because I saw an opportunity to make comics that could get the point across better than me writing a tweet. There are people who are very good at writing tweets. There are people who make a living off of writing tweets now. So it comes down to finding your, what do they call it? They call it ikigai. Ikigai, Japanese concept of untranslatable word. Reason of being, purpose for existence. Nobody can help you find that. You have to try and follow your heart and all that cheesy stuff.
It probably comes down to trusting yourself and actually act on these little impulses you have when you do have those impulses, and to see what happens, and willing to take a chance. Willing to trust your own intuitions. And I guess deep down, we all know what is the right thing to do as humans. Just do it. It's such a great tagline of Nike, but it comes down to just doing it, I think, the end of the day, and then just see what happens, and willing to be a little bit more spontaneous. I think that eventually will go a long way. And talking about spontaneity, you recently moving to El Salvador. You're a world traveler and you've been traveling all around. So when you pick your destination, like, what do you look at? How do you decide this is the next place to go? Like, what are some areas that you're particularly interested in when finding traveling spots?
Sometimes it would be circumstance that would take me to a place, like a job offer, or something like it. Sometimes it would be a passion. Like, I I really like everything Japanese. Like, I cannot, I'm a huge fan of it. Like, art, culture, language, literature, music, architecture, nature, food, blah, blah, blah. But so that took me to Japan, that made me study Japanese, and that was out of a passion. Other places I would randomly travel for a meetup and then end up staying. Other times I would look at that. I started doing this recently, that I would look at the political situation more, that I would look at the economical situation, that I would look at the regulations with regards to having a company or just having Bitcoin. That is a less romantic way, a more German way of tackling the thing. And in the end, that is not always ideal either, because you can find the place that is perfect for you on paper, but then you come there and there's no spark. What the hell is that spark? I don't know, but sometimes you have it, sometimes you don't. There are a million things that you can consider, and half a million of them are rational, and half a million of them are, no, probably like three-fourths of them are rational, and the rest is irrational. And sometimes you can have 9 rational reasons not to move to a place. The one irrational one will make you stay. And so yeah. I've had all experiences like that in all kinds of countries. And for example, a lot of people are, they want to leave Germany right now, which I can't blame them. But for them, moving to El Salvador would be like, they would die of a culture shock. So they're going to move to Switzerland. You know, which is like Germany, but the people are nicer.
What was your first impression when you traveled to El Salvador? And what do you think about El Salvador that clicked with you so strong and so fast?
I tried to look at it objectively in that I would say I came here with a certain mindset. I tried to look at it objectively and understanding I was subjectively influenced by the fact that this is Bitcoin country. So I was ready to like it, because I'm like, oh, they like Bitcoin, so it must be a great place. But it is a great place regardless of Bitcoin. And I felt an energy here that I haven't felt in really anywhere I've gone before. In the end, what it comes down to is the fact that most countries currently are they're on a downward trend, be it politically, be it economically, or both. Things are just not looking up for most people. In El Salvador, you have a country where a lot of things were fixed extremely quickly. Over a short time frame, this country was turned upside down. And there is an energy, there is an optimism here that I have not seen in my life ever anywhere, where people are so, they allow themselves to plan ahead, they allow themselves a longer time horizon, they allow themselves to hope and to have dreams. As a more like physical example, they allow themselves to open businesses because they don't need to worry about having to pay extortion money to gangs, for example. And just simply, they can walk on the street. Right. And it's incredible. And people who have lived here for a long time tell me it's a different country. And that is being able to bring that optimism to a country is an extremely huge achievement. And it reflects in the people. So I think it's an example of how leadership can shape your audience. So if you're a bad leader, that reflects on your audience. If you're a good leader, that also reflects on your audience. If you teach and you live an example of common sense, of low time preference, of patience, of modesty, but of ambition, of humbleness, but of discipline. Did I say patience? I think I did. But then that will shape the people who follow you as well. And so that is, it's like a, in a way, it's a give and take. And that you can see reflected here to an extreme degree.
You said President Bukele is someone who leads with common sense. And when you say common sense, like what do you refer to?
I mean the opposite of what they call, do I pronounce that correctly, demagoguery, which is what basically some would say democracy spirals into at the end when you have, for example, you have a politician who's campaigning. He wants votes. So he's going to say, I will spend money on this, and I will give you helicopter money here, and I will make this cheaper, and I will get rid of this thing. And people are like, yeah, I like that. And they vote him into office. And then he's like, well, actually, I can't deliver on that. Or he does like some high time preference policies that don't last and actually end up more destructive than it would have been if they just hadn't been done at all. The opposite of that is saying, look, we're in a precarious situation in this country. We have a lot of things to fix. It will take hard work. It will take sacrifices. So, for example, what they were expecting here is that when they would weed out the gangs and they would incarcerate gang members, that it would actually affect the economy, because a big chunk of the economy was run by gangs. They were churning a lot of money. So they were expecting that. For some reason, it didn't happen, which is great. So GDP is up, actually, I think. And they're actually doing great, and it didn't harm the economy. But so those are things where you're like, it's not going to be easy. It's going to take time. But here are the steps that we're taking. And that is the kind of leadership that Salvador has in their president. And you can tell it from when you talk to him, too, you can tell that he is a very reflective guy. So he's aware of a lot of things, and he's aware of the consequences of his actions. So you are basically you have to, with everything you do, every decision you make, you have to weigh the upsides and downsides of it. We all do that, right? But we do it for ourselves, for our companies. We don't do it for an entire country. So, and he has to do a lot of that, because he's not just doing it for his country, but the things he do, they upset other countries for some stupid totally. Reason and other organizations. So he's taking a lot of risk, and he has to handle that in a very smart way. And part of that smart way is saying, I'm going to go on social media and I'm going to be very transparent about the things that I do and how I do them. That is what I mean by common sense. It is so weird for us because it doesn't happen, because everything is planned and narrative and propaganda. And I'm not saying they don't use propaganda here. I think it's very normal. But I feel like a lot of times the politicians in our countries think we're idiots, and they actually don't care if we believe their narratives, because so long as some people believe it and so long as they are untouchable, it doesn't matter, right? So that's why it's like, oh, it's so weird. Like, is that like... That doesn't seem like a politician, so it must be shady. And so that's why, yeah. For example, the dictator narrative sticks very well, you know.
Right. I guess in the end, it comes down a lot to just being honest and realistic about the situation. And at least the fact that we recognize the current status quo is not good enough. And how can we build on top of this current situation and to approach the whole all the tricky situations with a lot of integrity and honesty and being realistic of the current resources and where we're lacking, that goes a long way. And it must be not easy. I can only imagine, I guess, how difficult it will be to juggle all these different parties with such high stake all over the place. And now you've made a big commitment to actually like actually make the move there. And I see you have a piano and I have a piano too. And whenever I choose to get a piano, it's like a huge thing, because it's such a big thing to move around.
Right?
Yeah, it's such, it shows a great commitment for sure. I can attest to that. So do you remember what was the defining moment of you deciding, okay, I'm moving to El Salvador? Do you remember that trigger?
It was not a defining moment. It was more of a process, I think, because I came here several times, because the first time I came, I was like, what the hell? Why is it? What is it with this place? It's crazy. Then I started looking into it. I started looking into like how things are run here and how things are happening here. And I came back and I thought, hold on, like this place is crazy. My approach was always to go with the flow to an extent. And in the end, you cannot know, you won't know if you like it, and won't know if it's going to work out if you don't go. And I've never done the thing, except the first time I left Germany, I've never done the thing where I would sit at home and be like, okay, that's El Salvador. I'm going to move there. And now I'm making a plan. And then 3 months from now, I'm moving there. Because then, well, not for any specific reason, but the risk that you run into is that you're going to make this plan and something goes wrong and then you start panicking, or you go there and it's not the way you expected. Whereas if you just go and you just kind of deal with, don't go blindly, I'm not saying that, but you deal with situations as they arise. You know you can't plan for everything, and you're gonna fix the challenges, overcome them as you go. You just have to remember that you're not the only person on this planet who has problems. And every problem can be fixed. And once you have that mindset, then you just, it becomes easier.
Last time I saw you, you said you were doing this pretend living thing in El Salvador, and that kind of stuck with me. It's such a great way to put it, is that you pretend living there. And that's kind of what I did when I was in Berlin. It's like I did maybe a couple weeks of touristing spots, and then the rest of the time, which is like majority of the time, I was just pretending that I lived there, and I was just doing, carrying out my life as usual, doing what I would normally do if I live elsewhere, and see how I feel and how I vibe with the place. And I think it's such a valuable and great concept to adapt when thinking about where to live next, what all big life decisions, I guess, is great to give ourselves that buffer without fully committing, so that we don't pressure ourselves into situations. And oftentimes what we as humans is that when things are in our head and in concept, we can love that concept, versus if that concept become reality, then we may actually hate it. So it's good to kind of have a playground to test out these concepts, to see if concepts equals reality and how you would actually handle that situation when this is your life instead of in your head. You taught me how to say your last name in German, so I'm going to challenge you again. Can you teach me how to say fix the money, fix the world in German?
I believe, and the German community is going to kill me for this. I know they have a German version of it and I forgot it. But I guess a good way to I'm not going to translate it literally, but a good way to translate it would be besseres Geld, bessere Welt.
Besseres Wet, besseres Wet. Did I totally butcher it?
Your pronunciation's too cute. Yeah, sorry. It's not angry enough. Better money, better world.
Besseres Wet, besseres Wet.
It's very cute.
I'm just going to stop here before I embarrass myself even further. Thank you for joining the show. And I have to share a personal note and make a contribution attribution to Lena, because Lena is the first person, the first Bitcoiner that I know. And it's the Bitcoiner who orange pilled me. So I guess like the Bitcoiner who orange pilled us, they'll always hold a special place. And I know Bitcoin changed my life as it did for everybody. Literally every Bitcoiner I've ever met, they all say that Bitcoin have changed my life, and it's the same for me. So I owe a huge thank you for this. And for this, I will be grateful for you forever. Thanks for joining the show.
God, I'm gonna cry.
Aww.
Thank you.
Yeah, literally, no, like, I'm seriously, so... it's I got so lucky, and I'm someone who you know, like not particularly savvy for technology or economics. I got very lucky to have got a Bitcoin job before I became a Bitcoiner. Otherwise, it will probably take me another 5 or 6 years until someone else do what I'm doing right now to hopefully bring more people onto Bitcoin with more personally relatable content. So I'm very, very grateful for what you did for the community. Bitcoin community is very, very lucky to have you. And you will become this kind of godmother figure almost for the next generation of Bitcoiners with all of the hodlers in their bedside, putting them to sleep. Mother and I have this vision of, you know, how like kids, they throw their teeth on the roof and hoping the tooth fairy would come to visit them. And I kind of imagine you as this kind of godmother fairy figure in Bitcoin for the next generation of Bitcoiners. So kudos to that, and I'm really, really happy to see you thriving in your current kind of adventure with Little Hodlers and the success it has so far with a global scale of Bitcoiners and their families. There's a lot of value in what you're doing for the community, and I'm just really glad that you're having a great time in El Salvador.
That just melted my heart. Thank you. Oh my God. It was really great because I was seeing how quickly you picked up on the Bitcoin narratives and the Bitcoin, like the different, like all the sectors that it touched. And it was really, really great to see. And I hadn't expected it because I had worked with many people who just lost interest very quickly because the obstacle at the beginning of your journey is so high. But you had such like such discipline in there and such like curiosity, and that it was really, really great to see. And it's even better to see you now that you have your own podcast, and it's so it's amazing that we meet at conferences, and it's so, so nice. I love it.
Hopefully to see you somewhere in the world, like always.
Yeah, we will.
Thank you for tuning in this episode, and thank you for your support. And now let's hear from our audience. Joe Martin Music sent me 10,000 sats on Fountain. Thank you, Joe. He says, awesome talk. We'll be sharing this episode with anyone who wants to learn more about Fountain and Value for Value. Absolutely. Value for Value is the way, it's the future of creating content, building communities for creators. And I appreciate your support on supporting me on Fountain and listening to the show on Fountain. Mike on Fountain sent me 5,000 sats on Fountain, saying, great episode, was good to hear about Nick's journey and more about this app. My Immortal podcast boosted 1,111 sats to me on Fountain. Thank you. The comment was, great combo, Vivian, perfect research for my upcoming chat with Nick. I also have a podcast called Value for Value that goes through the whole philosophy. You might enjoy it. Yes, let's definitely check it out. It's Value for Value podcast. I'm sure it's on Fountain as well. Thank you so much for supporting the human side of Bitcoin and Left with Bitcoin. And I'm your host, Vivian Ching. I will see you in the next episode.